Welcome back to the Fifth Estate podcast from the Wheeler Center. In this episode, Tim Soutphommasane and Scintilla Chingaipe join us to talk about hate, populism, and prejudice, and how they've played out in Australia. Here's our host, Sally Warhaft.
It's a real pleasure to have our guests here tonight to discuss this topic on hate, a difficult topic, one that's worn me down a bit, I have to say, in the few weeks that I've been thinking about it with all the other issues that it concerns in actual life pressing upon me. But it's a good time to be talking about this topic. And to do it, we have two wonderful guests. Scintilla Chingaipe is an award-winning journalist and filmmaker. She worked for many years at SBS World News reporting from Africa and Australia. Her documentary work includes Date My Race and Black As Me for SBS and the forthcoming ABC series Third Culture Kids. Scintilla has partnered with the Wheeler Centre too on several projects, including Australia's first anti-racism festival, Not Racist But, and the Africa Talk series. She's a member of the federal government's advisory group on Australia-Africa relations and a very welcome guest here tonight. Thanks. Tim Soutphommasane, of course, is a former race discrimination commissioner from 2013 to 2018. He's a political theorist and human rights advocate and now a professor at Sydney University. His books include Reclaiming Patriotism, The Virtuous Citizen, Don't Go Back to Where You Came From, and I'm Not Racist But. And his new, a little book, but a big book on hate, part of the MUP On series, which will be for sale down the back, thanks to readings after this event. Welcome, Tim. It's great to see you back here in Melbourne. I'll start with you, Tim, on, you know, what is this hate we speak of? What is it?
Well, unfortunately, we're seeing a lot of it on display at the moment in our politics and media. And when I think of where our political debate is right now, I believe we're in danger of seeing the normalisation or mainstreaming of racial hatred in particular. If we were to cast our memories back to 2018, I think that was the year when a lot of this really crystallised. The year started off with a big panic about African gangs here in Melbourne, because everyone here was apparently scared of going out to dinner. It was then followed up by some sustained criticisms by numerous senior federal government ministers about multiculturalism leading to ethnic segregation, about us veering into European-style separatism. You had commentary in sections of the media as well, stoking anxieties about immigration. In the words of one columnist, a tidal wave of immigration was overwhelming Australia such that we didn't know who us was anymore, who them were. And there was talk as well about ethnic colonies being formed by Jewish, Chinese and Indian migrant communities. And then later in the year, of course, we had Fraser Ranning delivering his maiden speech in the Commonwealth Parliament, where he used Nazi language in the form of the final solution to describe the immigration issue. And just 2 months later, we had Pauline Hanson as well moving a motion in the Senate that it was okay to be white, which is a well-known slogan used by white supremacists, and was supported in that motion by 23 government senators. So I think that's the evidence I would provide for the normalisation of racial hatred at the moment. What were once ideas regarded as out of bounds and beyond the realms of normal and reasoned political debate is now being openly entertained, not only on the fringes of our society, but in mainstream media. Just about every morning that you switch on the television and watch breakfast TV on some commercial TV stations, and it's being aired as well within the federal parliament by politicians, including senior politicians. And that to me is very concerning, and it represents a fundamental challenge to our democratic values.
What was going on to create this, do you think, in our parliament?
It depends on how long you want to go back and think about it. I feel that something changed in the last 5 or 6 years as a result of the prolonged debate that we had about free speech and the Racial Discrimination Act. Maybe that was because of the nature of my job and the fact that this was at the forefront of my mind for so long. But I can't help but think that in saying that people had a right to be bigots, then Attorney General George Brandis did signal to extremists in our society, and indeed others, that it was acceptable to vent racial and religious bigotry in others and believe that you had the complete and absolute protection of free speech. That, in other words, free speech meant hate speech was permissible. The fact that this issue was so prominent for so long, and you had two separate attempts by the federal government to repeal Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act, the fact that you had the Australian newspaper devoting hundreds of thousands of words in its pages to prosecuting this issue, the fact that you had a parliamentary inquiry set up to lay the groundwork for a second attempt to repeal the legislation, I can't help but think that that's contributed to a political environment in which it's now acceptable to air extreme ideas and try and justify that as a proper and valid exercise of freedom of speech. But there's obviously more than just one factor contributing to all this. If we look at what's happening in our media at the moment, we have a fragmenting media industry and media outlets who are struggling to cling on to their audiences in the face of technological change and social media. And to put it in very simple terms, what we've seen, unfortunately, is a monetization of hatred, where some media outlets are using racism and division as part of their business model. And if you look at some commercial TV networks, some newspaper outlets, I think you're seeing very clear signs of how this has become part of business as usual, with an emphasis there on business. And then on the political front, as well as the ideological push on free speech, the rise of Donald Trump and the alt-right or far-right movement aligned with nationalist populism has probably excited a lot of right-of-centre politicians here in Australia who believe that they can emulate that political shift and capture votes in the way that Donald Trump has. And all of these factors, in my view, have combined to legitimise race politics, and race politics, unfortunately, is back.
Sandila, first of all, to respond to what Tim said, but also to reflect on whether all of that has contributed to a change in society, or whether politicians and the media are having their own ideological tantrum in these matters, but it isn't actually changing the lived experience, perhaps, of people out in the world.
Yeah, I would agree with Tim in that there has been a big change in the last 18 months in terms of the normalisation of this sort of rhetoric. But I would actually, I mean, when I started my journalism career, this was about 2007, and at the time here in Victoria, there were these reports of, like it's happening today, African gangs, this idea that, you know, Africans... And this was when the Howard government had the humanitarian intake extended to Africa, and this was when Sudanese refugees were being brought in. And the argument at the time was that South Sudanese refugees were failing to integrate, and they were problematic and they were a problem. And that this was before the federal election, and there was a ramp up in this kind of rhetoric, and the media ran with it unchallenged, and there was this myth that, you know, Africans really were failing to integrate. And a couple of things happened around that time because of that language within the media that was quite racialized, essentially pointing to the Africanness of these people as the problem. There were two white men who you know, we're seeing these media reports, and went out and said in their neighbourhood, this came out in the court in the trial. They went out and said that, you know, we want to kill the N-word, and the neighbours reported that this happening. They went out, the house that they were squatting in, they sprayed, you know, fuck the N-word on the wall. And that very same day that they sort of said to people around them that they wanted to find black people and kill them, one 18-year-old boy, his name was Liep Goni, his mum had sent him out to buy a can of paint, and he was returning home through the park in Noble Park, and these two men that had said hours earlier that they wanted to kill a black person found their target in this 18-year-old, and they bashed him to death with a metal pole. When the case went to trial, all of this came out, and the judge said that, "I don't think it's a racially motivated attack," because a week earlier, one of the men had helped a homeless African man. A lot of academics, including Karen Farquharson at the University of Melbourne, have argued that it was indeed a racist attack, and it was incited by, in many instances, the reporting in the media around the African community, because they were blaming Africans as the problem and the cause for you know, a lot of the crime in Victoria. What also happened after that was that the federal government stopped the intake of African refugees, because they used this as a reason to justify that change in policy. And so that was 2007, and I have seen the repetition of that in our media every year ever since. There was a time when, you know, the mythical Apex gang was the code word for African and black in this state. You know, it was blame the Apex gang. The Apex gang is coming out to get you. Even at a time when authorities stated that race had nothing to do with the perpetrators of the alleged attacks, a lot of people in the media found it very convenient to just blame those incidents on this mythical group that has never existed. And then that repeated itself the following summer with the African gangs, and we're seeing it over and over again. So are we learning the lessons? I don't think so. And I think, as Tim said, I think for a lot of people within the media, it is a very commercially viable model to, you know, continue to stoke these sorts of fears.
It was like clockwork in the new year last year in 2018. I think it was in, you know, the first, second, third of January that these reports of Sudanese gangs began, and it almost is, it was somewhat farcical to me, the sort of direct link that could be made between that and the forthcoming state election. Since then, though, and if, you know, what you've described, Tim, about 2018, of course, in the past couple of weeks, there's been the terrible crime in Christchurch, and a noticeable change in the rhetoric, particularly from the Prime Minister. What's going on there, and are you pleased by it?
Well, only to a point, right? I would have thought that Christchurch and the terror attack there committed by an Australian white supremacist would have led to a resetting of our political debates on race and extremism. I mean, I would have imagined, for example, that the government might have decided to announce that it was going to fund a strong national anti-racism campaign. It could have decided to strengthen hate speech laws to prevent the escalation of hate speech into political and racial violence. It could have put an emphatic end to race politics by, for example, making clear that certain political parties would be preferenced last in the upcoming federal election. If we had seen those things, and maybe I think we would have seen a genuine shift in our political debate and perhaps even political culture. And yet within a week of the Christchurch massacre, and while the country was still trying to make sense of what had happened there and the implications of it on public safety here in Australia and public debate here in Australia, you had the Prime Minister pivot to the issue of immigration. That to me was very telling because we all know that an election's coming up very soon, but I would interpret from all of that that there's a preparedness to conduct business as usual and to entertain race politics rather than denounce it and rule it out. So while some of the comments made by the Prime Minister were fitting and appropriate, I don't think there was a sustained change in rhetoric and positioning from the Prime Minister and the government on this issue because of the lack of concrete steps taken in response to Christchurch, which I imagined could have been part of a genuine resetting of the public debate.
Were you surprised, Sandila, with the response from the Prime Minister?
No. I think pretty much exactly what Tim said. I think part of, again, we are going into an election, so there was a bit of reading of the general atmosphere in terms of the comparison one in terms of leadership style between Jacinda Ardern and how she had responded to the Christchurch attack, and you know, maybe I'm cynical, but I think that there was within the circles of the government people that sort of saw that and sort of went, well, we can't essentially react like we've always reacted because people won't see this as the way that they should. But I think that in terms of how we talk about migrants and how we talk about Muslims and how we talk about, I mean, not even just talking about recent arrivals of groups, but even how we talk about Indigenous Australians in this country, a lot of the language has for a very, very long time been very unpleasant, and it hasn't, you know, and it's done because we know it is politically expedient to win votes based on fear. If you tell people that they've got something to be scared about, if, you know, you've got immigrants coming in and they're taking your jobs, well, then that gives someone a reason to kind of go, well, actually, maybe that is true, even though that's not the basis for that kind of inequality. It's not because of migration, in that sense. But, you know, it is expedient, and they're going to keep relying on that tactic for as long as they can. And dog whistling is effective to that extent. And so I don't see it sort of waning anytime soon, because one, we're also very reluctant to actually talk about the fact that we have a very serious problem with racism in this country.
And can I add to that too? We're seeing at the moment a mutation in how the language of race politics is being used as well. And I'm referring here to the false equivalence that has been constructed in the last week or so, where politicians and media commentators have directly equated the Greens and a supposed threat posed by the Greens as equivalent to the threat posed by One Nation. You know, this is another form of on both sides that was used in the aftermath of Charlottesville in the United States by Donald Trump. The construction of a supposed fringe or extremist element that is the opposite or the equivalent of the racist threat being posed by the far right. But if we just unpack the logic there, there's something deeply perverse. If you're going to associate anti-racism, for instance, with the moral standing of racism. And this is part of the political discourse that we have about around racism more generally, the idea that, well, you know, you might have racism, but frankly, the real damage is done by those who create more division by opposing it. That's the kind of logic, and that's just simply wrong. I mean, let's be clear, the real division caused with respect to racism comes from racism. It doesn't come from our response to it, and our response to it should not be characterised in that way. But what we've seen in the past week with a sustained conflation of a supposed Greens threat with an extremist threat posed by One Nation is a sign of how the race politics that we've seen in the past 18 months in particular is now undergoing a mutation.
I'm curious about what is distinctively Australian about it, both culturally and politically, I suppose. I mean, politically, in the United States, it was the Tea Party, I suppose, that began the legitimising certain forms of hatred in America. We haven't had that here. What's distinctively Australian in our lack of civility, at best, to put it?
Maybe it doesn't reside in our lack of civility, but it resides more in how we define racial issues or define racism. I mean, if we just go back to something Scintilla said earlier about what the judge in that murder case said about the crime not being racially motivated, there is still this idea within the Australian consciousness that something isn't really or truly racist unless it's done by someone who's wearing a white Ku Klux Klan hood, or unless they're also waving about their membership card of an organised racist movement while they're spewing racist epithets or dealing out violence that that is being targeted at someone because of their race. And there's a blindness to racism in its various forms here that we see not only from people who may not have any particular sophisticated understanding of society or politics. I mean, you know, this is a judge. And we see this as well in those who work in our media and those who work in our in politics, those who occupy positions of authority in other of our public institutions. So I think there's something distinctly Australian in our blindness to racial difference and to colour, this insistence that we have about us not seeing race or not seeing racism or believing that racism really only exists if it's in the form of slavery or segregation, as opposed to everyday and institutionalized discrimination that we still have. So I would say that's, you know, this is different to what you'd get in America or Britain, for example, where I think there is more open acknowledgement that racism exists and people do talk about racial difference more forthrightly. We're incapable of even doing that or even acknowledging racism when it occurs in violent forms.
Mm. Can I just add to what Tim said? And because one of the things that I feel like tends to happen whenever there's discourse around racism, it's like everyone's like, oh, the R word again, don't mention it, or there you go again, throwing around the R word. And again, it is this, there's a very elementary understanding of what racism is. And just for the purposes of this conversation, I think I'll just try and simplify when we're talking about racism in this way, what we're actually meaning. So a lot of academics break down the ways in which racism manifests itself. So one of them is very overt racism, which is what I think pretty much everyone in this room would be able to recognise. It's things like, you know, lynchings, et cetera, that is considered overt racism. And then you've got implicit bias or unconscious bias, and this is when prejudices show up without necessarily being aware of it. So say, for example, you're someone that comes from a migrant background and you don't have, you know, your name isn't an Anglo-Saxon name, for example, and you're applying for a job and the employer sort of decides to not give you the job because they have all of these preconceived ideas about who they think you are. That's one way that it manifests itself. And then you've also got institutional racism. And this is when, you know, systems sort of uphold ways which, you know, hinder some groups and, you know, prop up other groups. And perfect examples that you can see this manifestation is within the the ways in which you can see this is through the criminal justice system in this country. So when you think about the rates of incarceration of Indigenous Australians, how the fact that they're underrepresented in our population, yet they're overrepresented in our prison system, is a clear manifestation of structural racism. That is racism. It's not hyperbole. You know, that's what it is. So when we're talking about it, it's not people kind of going, you know, it's bad people with bad intentions. It is a system that has been maintained for at least 400 years that does, you know, preference some groups over others, and it manifests itself in our society in various ways. And when we're trying to unpack it and dismantle it, we're not sort of trying to say, you know, you're a bad person or whatever, but it's actually kind of going, what are the ways in which, based on your race, that you are perhaps being denied an opportunity in this country. And this is kind of what we're talking about when we talk about racism. It's not just you're a bad person that's doing bad things. It's incredibly complicated. And that's why when we have these conversations, it's very unhelpful when it's on a morning news program and there's a panel of people that don't even know what racism means in that context. And then they're sort of asked to debate, is this or isn't this racist? And they're like, well, no, it's not. It's like, well... You know, it's like it's a bit more complicated than that. And especially because we have had racist policies in this country. I mean, the White Australia policy was an explicitly racist policy. So we have a lot in our history that really speaks to the fact that this is not something that we're willing to really look at and understand and try to dismantle.
Tim, you write in the book, and you've said it many times too, that Australia just remains really conditioned by the cultural power of that early framework of what Australia should be. You also write that Australians are particularly sensitive about racism. We don't even, you've just expressed not understanding the meaning of it, but that we don't really know how to even talk about it. Do you sense that too? Is there a particular sensitivity in among Australians to the idea of racism?
I think it's a deeply uncomfortable topic. I mean, for anyone, it doesn't matter which side you're sitting on, whether you know, you're someone that comes from a group that's been, oppressed historically, or you're on the side of the oppressor historically, like whichever side you're sitting on, it's deeply uncomfortable. It's not the kinds of conversations that you want to enter in, but we have to enter into them if things are going to change. And we can't keep kind of going, well, no, that was just one bad egg, therefore the rest of us aren't like that. It's like, you know, if we can try and at least take the emotion out of it and really kind of just look at what's going on, I think we'll be in a better place to actually address the challenges that confront us at the moment.
Where do you think it's heading, you know, particularly, I suppose, politically, and the sort of frameworks and policies and ideas and leadership that could change this sense of assault, I suppose, that you described, Tim?
I'm not sure we're going to see a dramatic change soon. As much as it pains me to say that, when you still have one nation on the political scene, when you still have far-right activists who are emboldened, I don't think we're going to see it go away immediately. And we just had a state election in New South Wales, for example, that's returned Mark Latham to the Legislative Council in New South Wales. And in the election campaign in New South Wales, he campaigned in part on a policy platform that included DNA testing of Aboriginal people. Now, that's an example of how eugenicist ideas or something approximating such ideas are going to be part of the debate in a state legislature in New South Wales. Now, I would hope that there is a resetting of some kind at the federal level. That depends in part on the outcome of the imminent federal election. But if political leaders are able to turn down the temperature and set a better tone for public debate on these issues, then we might see a return to some sanity and some civility. But whether or not that will happen, I think, is an open question, and in part will depend on whether politicians feel pressure from the community and from citizens about this, because I don't think that the majority of Australian society necessarily endorses race politics, but it's important that the voice of concerned citizens are heard here. All too often we're hearing from a particular section of society that is deeply uncomfortable with social and cultural change, but the majority who are generally more comfortable with the modern reality of Australian society, their views aren't always heard or expressed in the same way. So that's where I think the best prospects for change might come. It's going to involve people speaking up about these issues and putting pressure on politicians to change their ways.
That's been happening for a long time, though, hasn't it? I mean, we can talk about a peak, you know, last year or at other, you know, times. People have always, or for a long time, spoken about these issues. The other thing we've always heard our politicians remark on is that we're the most successful multicultural society in the world, which drives me nuts every time I hear it. Not because I don't think we're good at it, I do. But I think there's no evidence to suggest we're the best at it. But what are we good at? What are we the best at in relation to it? Do either of you, have anything you can single out that really would give evidence to this common refrain?
Well, I think there is evidence to say that we're one of the best. Whether or not we're the best is up for debate. But if you're looking at social mobility at a very general level, then I think it's fair to say that migrants and the children of migrants do well in participating in Australian life. And there's something good and something worth celebrating in the fact that the children of migrants in Australia, on average, outperform the children of Australian-born parents when it comes to educational attainment and employment in this country. Now, that's not going to be the case in many countries in Europe, for example. I mean, if you were to look at France or Germany or the Netherlands or even the UK, I'm not sure that actually would be the case, but it is the case here in Australia. The problem with the refrain of Australia being the best or most successful multicultural society in the world is more that it's used to close down critique, or it's used to deflect from the problem of racism. There's nothing contradictory in saying that, yes, we are for the most part a successful multicultural society, but racism still exists. I think those two things can exist together, and they do in our society. And if we're going to talk about our success as a country too, it would be blind of us to not pay any attention to the structural disadvantages and injustices experienced by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people too, which is another part of where I would suspect there's some discomfort in how the most successful multicultural society refrain is used. And that's where the problem, in my view, lies. It's not in the factual basis of that assertion. It's more in the use of such an idea to close down the debate or deflect from a challenge to whether we can do better. And I certainly think we can do better. Too often that idea is used to say that we've reached the point where we can declare mission accomplished, and that's not the right approach.
Mm. What about the world? And obviously, you know, these debates of different forms that are going on elsewhere, particularly America, particularly Europe, particularly everywhere. We're living through a period of real sort of strong men leaders popping up all over the place at the moment. How does what's going on in Australia fit with the rest of the world, Scintilla?
I mean, I guess you could definitely see parallels between what's going on, particularly in Western democracies, to here in Australia. But when I think about just one of the things that you asked in that question about, you know, what can we be looking at in terms of trying to find solutions? One of the things that really encouraged me, I think, in the last week out of the Christchurch attack was that the country moved to ban the circulation of that manifesto that the Australian white supremacists used. And I think that is a big move. I think, you know, being able to actually call it for what it is and say that we will not have any of this, any part of any of this, and anyone that's seen to circulate this, because we do recognise, and this is where I'm very fascinated with how the media reckons with all of this. And I think that in the US, that the media are having conversations around how do you deal with the rise in this sort of white nationalism, but also, you know, how do you interrogate, you know, these people from these groups where you're not platforming their views. And I don't think our media has reached that level of maturity in terms of recognizing that when you've got Fraser Anning giving a press conference, it's not an opportunity to just have that rolling coverage without interrogating it, without contextualizing it, without presenting any facts, without even challenging that position. We had was it Steve Bannon late last year when Four Corners essentially gave him advertising. There was about 40 minutes of primetime television. The first 3 minutes was a package that kind of tried to explain why he matters, but the rest of the 30 minutes didn't actually, one, shed anything new that Australian audiences needed to know. But if the argument was that there is a concern that these ideas are being shared within Australia, why were we not hearing those views? And this idea that, you know, if people just hear these crazy ideas, then, you know, normal people will just dismiss them and see them for what it is really problematic, because I think when you're thinking about extremism, and in this instance white supremacy, you don't need the masses to agree with what you're saying. You just need a couple of people that, you know, see people saying those sorts of things and are emboldened to go out and carry out these sorts of attacks. So it's not a case of kind of going, well, people will see this and make sense of it, and then, you know, I remember 4 years ago when I worked at SBS, I went to cover one of the Reclaim Australia rallies, and it's a story that I reflect back on now with a sense of regret in how I reported on it because of what I now know. And it was one of those things where you report on protests like any other protest. So you find out who the protesters are, and then you find out the opposing group that don't agree with them. And then, you know, you've got a package pretty much. And at the time, there was Syrian refugees. I think the first intake of Syrian refugees were being resettled, and charity had found these old nursing homes, these abandoned nursing homes, and had turned them into temporary housing for these refugees. And, you know, these people set up this rally outside this nursing home saying, you know, our old people don't have anywhere to stay because they've been kicked out, you know, when the fact that these nursing homes had been abandoned for about 2-3 years and no one was using them. And I remember going in and kind of getting the grab and getting the police on the horses, because it's television and it all looks very dramatic, and going back to the newsroom and sitting and, you know, having a laugh at the fact that they were saying some of the craziest things I'd ever heard, and then countering what they'd said with activists from the Syrian communities who were defending their humanity, you know, that, you know, we are obviously fleeing this conflict, et cetera, et cetera. And then that was the context in which that story aired. And that's a template that I pretty much see ongoing when it comes to issues to do with race. Now, why that is problematic is that, first of all, the racists in that case, the Reclaim Australia, should not have been given the same equivalence as the Syrian group. It's not the same thing. But also, this wasn't just any other protest. This was about, you know, inciting hatred in the community for new arrivals in this country who were trying to make this country their home. And I think that our media hasn't yet reached that point of, you know, really reckoning with how much we platform these views and not actually recognizing that you don't need to get mass appeal for these ideas. You just need one person to watch what you're saying unchallenged, uncritiqued, and they're emboldened by it. And, you know, next thing you know, you've got these horrible, horrible incidents, and then we keep asking ourselves, but how did we get here? How did we get here? And, you know, a lot of people have been saying, like, this is how we get here.
Correct.
You know?
Yeah, and I think on the international front, you've seen media elsewhere conduct self-criticism and introspection, particularly after the rise of Donald Trump and the rise of the far right in Europe. We're not seeing that critical self-awareness from the Australian media. And there's a denial that there's even a problem in how they're conducting their interrogation of extremism. To give an example, even after the Christchurch massacre and the debate that we were having about the mainstreaming of extremism. You had Channel 7 on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland giving free time to Fraser Anning, where a softball interview was conducted with him. Now, my view is he's an elected representative. He should be interviewed, but it's how you interview him that matters. Yeah. You've got to scrutinise. Yeah. If he's making an assertion about something, ask him for the evidence, ask him for the facts, push him to justify what he's said. I mean, do we give a free run to pedophiles on mainstream media? Do we give a free run to Islamist terrorists to media? I mean, I don't seem to see that happening. Well, if we don't see it happening for those forms of extremism, why are we then seeing it for white supremacists? Why is there an exception here? And this is putting it crudely, but this is the reality of where Australia's media coverage of these issues currently lies. There isn't that level of critical self-awareness about what's happening yet.
Would you agree with Santilla, though, that, say, not interviewing Steve Bannon is something that's going to help?
I think it's open to debate. I mean, I think if you were going to interview Steve Bannon, you shouldn't be exonerating him on racism, as Sarah Ferguson did on air in that Four Corners interview. Now, you know, again, if we were to use an analogy, I can't imagine a senior journalist doing that and exonerating a member of ISIS, telling them they're not a terrorist, of course, or a pedophile, telling them, of course, you're not a pedophile. Well, we have here a well-known advocate associated with Breitbart, and who has been involved in the advocacy of a white ethno-state in the United States and in the advent of the far right. That should speak for itself. I mean, I think it's remarkable to be exonerating someone in an interview when critical scrutiny should be the standard. So I don't think, in my view, it's about enforcing a blanket ban on people with extreme views. But if you are going to interview them, if they're going to enjoy a platform, it's crucial that there's interrogation of this and that there's also an effort to hear from those who are affected by the speech that is being aired. So don't leave a particular view unchallenged, but rather give the full context to what has been aired. And, you know, I think journalists will always say, well, we leave it to our viewers or our readers to make up their own minds. Well, let your viewers and readers make an informed decision when they make up their minds. That, I think, is what we expect of all journalists. I don't think there's anything exceptional in that. What I think people are objecting to is the fact that there isn't that kind of standard being upheld, and what we're seeing are softball interviews, not hard scrutiny.
And can I just add, if it wasn't clear, I wasn't saying that Steve Bannon shouldn't have been interviewed. It was the way in which he was interviewed. Yeah. And also, from an editorial perspective, I really did question why someone who is no longer a newsmaker, he's not part of the Trump White House anymore, deserved that much airtime. And, you know, if the argument was that there were people in Australia that shared those views, it probably would have been more beneficial to hear from those people and then, you know, get Bannon to respond to that. I think that would have at least helped to sort of try to contextualise what was going on rather than going, you know, this is Steve Bannon and this is what he's going to say.
In America, the membership of hate groups has plummeted in recent times because of the rise of the internet.
Because it's gone up. There have been three reports that have come out in the last couple of years that have seen an increase in hate groups and hate group membership.
Well, that not according to the Southern Law
it's
Poverty
Southern,
Law.
It's the Southern Poverty Law Centre.
Wow, we're getting different
but
stats
that's fine.
From the. This was from a discussion with David Neewart, who works for them, who talked about this, that the actual membership of groups in the traditional way that people used to go out and have to give their identity and address and so on for a membership of a group has really gone down because the internet has allowed people to join without joining, to maintain anonymity, and so not have to join in the traditional way. I wondered what, you know, who's tracking this even in Australia? We don't have a group like that. But what do we know about membership or connections?
Yeah, the simple answer is we're not tracking it very well, and police and law enforcement authorities haven't taken the threat of far-right extremism as seriously as they should, as they should have. We have very poor collection of data. Many police at the state and territory, many police forces at the state and territory level don't have dedicated units to hate or bias crimes. There was one in New South Wales, but it was very modestly resourced and is no longer operating as a unit under the nomenclature of a hate or bias crimes unit. And that's an insight into the lack of infrastructure we have to truly understand what's happening. But I think it's fair to say that we are seeing what you've described, which is that there is a lot of activity online, that the energy around extremist groups is electronic for the most part, but there's no guarantee that such electronic activity will not translate into real physical activity. So when you've had rallies in various cities against Islam, for example, or done under so-called patriotic banners, many of those groups would have been mobilised electronically, but they were brought out publicly and physically. And this is the threat that we're faced with here. We can downplay the electronic or social media dimension and say, well, this is just keyboard warriors. But we would be complacent at our peril, because it doesn't take a big jump for people to go from online activity to then taking matters into their own hands, as happened in Christchurch.
We'll take some questions from you now. If you'd like to ask something, just put your hand up and start talking when a microphone's put into it.
Thank you to the Wheeler Centre for another stimulating discussion tonight. I'm 69 years old, and I have never in my life discriminated against anyone on the basis of race. You did mention eugenics. I'd like to quote President Clinton, who addressed a campaign rally in 2016 in Tennessee, I believe, and he said, "You know what else we learned from the human genome? We learned that unless your ancestors, every one of you," and he pointed to the crowd, "are 100% from sub-Saharan Africa, we are all mixed race people." That's the way I view Australian society. We're all mixed race people, and I would prefer that we treated each other the same. You mentioned Southern Poverty Law Centre. You might tell the audience about what happened to two of their executives just recently.
Yeah, I'd like a question too. Is there a question?
The question was, what do you have to say about Mr. Clinton's comments? Is he a racist for saying that we're all mixed race people?
No, he's not. And most biologists would say that there's no scientific to race. No scientific basis to race. That you know, what Santilla, Sally, and I would share in our genetic composition would be remarkably uniform. That I would probably have more genetic differences with someone from a similar racial or ethnic background when compared to Sally and Santilla. That's how the biological science of race works. Now, where some people conclude from that is this. They conclude, well, therefore, racism doesn't exist, which is an erroneous conclusion to draw. There may be no biological basis. No, I'm not saying that you are, but the import of your question does raise this as an issue to be addressed. The mere fact that biology says that race may not exist as a scientific concept does not mean that racism as a social phenomenon does not exist, because clearly it does, and clearly people are discriminated on the basis of their colour or ethnic background or national origin, those things which we would regard as synonymous with this thing called race. And that would be my that would be my response, that while what Bill Clinton said was perfectly accurate in a scientific sense, it should not in any way be interpreted, and I'm glad to hear that you don't interpret it that way, but others might be interpreting it another way. It should not be interpreted to mean that racism does not exist.
Anything to add there, Scintilla?
Tim said everything, really. I mean, I really don't like getting into those sorts of conversations just because it flattens the whole the real life consequences and experiences of racism. And I do understand that you perhaps might not necessarily see yourself as discriminatory, but when we talk about dismantling racism, many of us, because we do live on colonised land, are complicit in and beneficiaries of racism in this country. So it's a complicated conversation, and one that I wouldn't, no answer would be able to give it any justice.
A perfect example of racism in Australia would be the refugees on Manus and Nauru. They've been languishing there for 5+, you know, some people have been there longer. Do you see any resolution to that situation? Like, how do we resolve that?
Based on what we know of the major political parties' position on this, I suspect we still have some way to go before there's a fundamental or comprehensive reset on this. With the connection to race, I think it's been used by some as a surrogate for race, or has been used as a proxy for race. I suspect that the hostility that some people in our society have to boat rivals is bound up in the origin of those people, as opposed to simply just the mere mode of their arrival here. And if we're talking about where race politics in contemporary Australia or living memory came back, there'd be many who would say that it came back in the 1990s when mandatory detention was introduced in 1992, that and perhaps the 1996 election and the appearance of Pauline Hanson in the federal parliament were the two times in the 1990s when you had a racialisation or something approximating that in our debate returning.
Hi, Tim and Scintilla. Thank you so much for your conversation tonight. So I'm a woman of colour sitting in a room that's mostly white people. And tonight you considered how racial hate has been inflamed and enlarged by the media, which seems to me such an abstract thing that I'm powerless to change. But I guess, what would you tell this room of white people who are presumably allies to do to lessen this hate? Are there concrete actions they can take? I ask this because I feel powerless in the face of racial hate.
Thank you for your question. I don't think that there is any one panacea to sort of solve the problem of racism. And I really struggle with suggesting what's the one thing that people can do. I think perhaps the simplest thing that people can do is being informed. I always think that reading enough about an issue and understanding the complexity of these sorts of issues that we're talking about is always a good step. One of the things that I, like a practical thing, is complaining, lodging a complaint if you see something in the media that makes you feel uncomfortable, you think it's factually incorrect, or perhaps the media didn't do their job. I think there is something to be said about the complaint system and holding those institutions to account, and that is quite an effective thing. But it's very, very difficult. It's difficult talking about racism in this country, and especially when, and I think Tim probably understands better than anyone else, when you're publicly talking about racism, you tend to cop a lot of criticism yourself. And so I can't imagine what it must be like when you're feeling a bit overwhelmed trying to talk about these sorts of things.
Yeah, and I'd add, I hope you don't feel powerless. So I think it's great that you're here and you're speaking up and asking a question. If you were genuinely powerless, you wouldn't have used your voice in that way. So I hope that you continue to speak about these issues and find others who you can speak in concert with. As for others in the room, if you haven't experienced racism yourself, and racism to me means experiencing prejudice or discrimination and losing some power through that. So power is very important here. You know, racism is about power. If you haven't experienced that, then I hope that you're prepared to suspend your judgment, listen to what others say, and try and put yourself in the shoes of others. Very often you get the impression that some people believe that minorities like to play the victim card or just love to complain about racism and discrimination. Frankly, it's the last thing that people want to talk about. If you think it's uncomfortable hearing about this, think about how uncomfortable it is to experience it or to live it. And I think there's often a failure of empathy on race issues because there's such defensiveness about the issue. And it comes back to how we understand racism and how often we define it in terms of intention rather than in terms of impact. Racism is as much about impact as it is about intent. And if we can understand that basic proposition and understand that power is involved in racism, then perhaps we'll be in a better position to have a better conversation.
If you're talking about power too, of course, the most powerful in our land are still overwhelmingly white men. And in some respects, perhaps a lot of the discussion about women's rights in recent times have jumped ahead discussions about race. Yeah. So that every time you see a leader of a powerful institution, that person is almost always white.
And I think even in the conversation around the rise in white nationalism, a lot of it, when you look at all the alleged attackers, whether it was in Christchurch or it was the Episcopalian Church in the United States or it was the synagogue also in the United States, a lot of what drives this kind of behaviour is this sense that there is a loss of power, that, you know, that white people are losing their power and that newer groups are sort of trying to take over. And that's gaining momentum, and people really, really do believe that that's going to happen, and are trying to put a stop to it. And in cases like Christchurch, for example, it ends in very, very terrible ways.
Yeah, and this is a brutal reality of the subject matter here. We can often think that racism comes from ignorance, or that education is the only solution to this if we really want to deal with the causes of racism. So the idea there is that there's defective reasoning involved, which leads to racism, when the reality is there's also power involved. And that's difficult to tackle because if people feel like they're losing power, it becomes harder then to change their minds. But I think that makes it all the more important for people of goodwill to regard this as a problem that affects all of us because we don't want to end up in a society where there are people who feel powerless and want to take matters into their own hands. That's a very dangerous place to be.
Well, we will we'll have to wait and see, won't we, what comes. It's going to be a particularly interesting to see how some of this plays out in the forthcoming election, to hear about the way we talk about Australia in regard to some of these matters, but also well into the future. We've got a long way to go, obviously, but it's been great to hear from the two of you tonight. Thank you so much for giving up your time.
Thank you
all for coming and listening so well. Thank you.
Santhila Chingaipe and Tim Soot Pomazan in conversation with Sally Warhaft for the Fifth Estate. This episode was recorded on Tuesday, the 2nd of April 2019, Federal Budget Night at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne. If you're listening now, you might already be a subscriber to our podcast, which means perhaps you find the series interesting or informative. We would love it if you shared it with someone else or left us a review on iTunes. You'll find over 100 interviews in our series archive at wheelercentre.com, as well as several other podcast series, hundreds of videos, and a lot more. In 2 weeks, we'll return for a chat about Australia's compulsory voting laws and what they mean for our democracy. Until then, take care.